Welcome everyone to Citizens Climate Lobby Climate Advocate Training Lesson Number 2. My name is Amy Bennett and I am Director of Operations with Citizens Climate Lobby and I'm out in California. But first up tonight, Brett's going to give us an overview of what we've covered so far. Brett?
Excellent. Thanks and welcome back everyone. As Amy mentioned, my name is Brett Cease. I'm down here in Dallas, Texas as the Director of Volunteer Education and Engagement for CCL, also helping our Third Coast Regional Coordination. And as many of you probably already know, we reviewed the intro call last week, as well as the webinar for Climate Advocate Training Part 1. If you haven't had a chance to do that yet, we recommend that you jump on and follow this pathway whenever you can. You can find that recording on the intro by going to our website and then clicking on that magnifying glass in the upper right, and then typing in intro call in the text box by that arrow. On the intro call, like we reviewed on the prior webinar, we discussed the founding and history of Citizens Climate Lobby, and then we talked about how CCL works to create political will and how our fundamental perspective is that politicians respond to political will rather than creating it themselves. Finally, we described our legislative proposal, Carbon Fee and Dividend, which we believe will address climate change in the most rapid, comprehensive, and equitable manner as a best first step for addressing climate change. Then, on the Lesson 1 Climate Advocate Training call, we covered CCL's organization and structure, how citizens create political will, and the tools that we use to create and include political will with our laser talks. This lesson, for Lesson Number 2, will cover three other topics: CCL's methodology, finding common ground and building relationships. We'll talk about discussing an example of how this methodology worked to create political will in the real world. And then we'll close with the reasoning for a revenue neutral price on carbon and how carbon fee and dividend works. I'll pass it back over to you, Amy.
Thanks, Brett. So if you've listened to the intro call or lesson number one of this series, you've probably picked up on bits and pieces of our core values. We've discussed how showing respect and appreciation for all, even those who oppose us. We've talked about Gandhi. We've discussed how we should always be striving to look for the best in others. And from day one, Citizens Climate Lobby is an organization that is focused on what we are in favor of, not what we're against. Tonight, we'll explain a Citizens Climate Lobby concept, looking for common ground, because finding common ground is key to any long-term relationship. And long-term relationships are what CCL is all about. Mm-hmm. Building long-term relationships with members of Congress and their staff is critical for our success. Here's the good news. We're absolutely convinced that we can find some common ground with anyone. When we look for common ground, we start in three places. We look for shared values, we look for social connections, and we look for places we care about. Regarding shared values, it can start on the most simple level. If you have kids, consider that most members of Congress have children and are concerned for their future as well. Although most staffers don't have kids, maybe you can connect with them as a future parent. So during meeting introductions, mention your kids or your grandkids. And Brett will take it from here.
Great. Thanks, Amy. Other examples of shared values include anything from one's religious beliefs to general outlook for a safe and prosperous future, energy independence, freedom of choice. It's always productive to find where you overlap with common values. And when you and a member of Congress or their staff find them in that background, make sure to keep emphasizing the connection in your interactions. CCL's legislative proposal, Carbon Fee and Dividend, embraces a lot of conservative Republican values. So if you're with a meeting with a conservative member of Congress, then make a connection between yourself and their conservative values and carbon fee and dividend during your introduction. Here's one quick example. After 5 years of building a relationship with their member of Congress in Texas, the group found that their member told them about the common ground they had was this: we all agree that efforts to reduce emissions should work hand in hand with economic well-being, along with that member's confidence that the U.S. should continue to lead emissions reductions by seeking cleaner air through American technology and innovation without sacrificing affordable energy or middle-class jobs. On that point of social connections, we learn about the people we meet with in advance. So for members of Congress, we find out about any of their former jobs, schools, clubs, interests. However, we want to make sure that you also have the space to ask for that information in the meeting so that we can collect it and build that relationship for future as well. Quick example. In meetings with a congressional aide, you know, we usually start by briefly introducing ourselves. And after we're done, we want to make sure to also say, you know, you've heard a little bit about us. Can you now tell us a little bit about yourself? You know, your hometown, where you went to school, how you ended up in D.C. with Congressman Jones. You know, also, can you help us understand your role in this office on energy policy? And I think the key thing is to highlight this isn't just being polite. These are real things that we want to know. And if there's a hometown or college connection with somebody on our lobby team, you better be sure we're going to make that connection. And that's how you build a long-term relationship and relaxes the people we meet with as well. It gets them talking about themselves instead of feeling lectured at. Lastly, as Amy mentioned, common ground can also literally be a patch of ground on this earth, our turf, a place that we love, that we know the member of Congress or staffer loves. We found that no matter who we talk to, no matter who we're in a meeting with, people love their home community and this larger world passionately. So in a little bit, we'll actually jump into an exercise to get us all to think about how using our own stories and experiences as a basis for common ground can build that. But first, Amy's going to share a specific story that highlights how one local CCL group began a relationship with their congresswoman, putting the framework we've just described into action.
Thank you, Brett. When Congresswoman Mia Love first met with Citizens Climate Lobby volunteers in her Utah district as a candidate for the House, she was not supportive of Citizens Climate Lobby's pitch, but they were struck with her listening ability and her impressive job of steering the conversation to areas of agreement. Her love of running, her appreciation for the outdoors, trail access, and air quality. Over the next half year, the same local Citizens Climate Lobby volunteers began to build essential relationships with Representative Mia Love's environmental aide and other staffers, sharing their appreciation for the Congresswoman's work, stopping by to share constituent comments about climate action, inviting them to climate change-related events happening in their district, and even having them over for a potluck while getting to know them personally. When Representative Love held her first public town hall in the district, 8 CCL volunteers attended and asked her questions on climate change. Even though during the meeting, Representative Love deflected off the topic of climate change, the volunteers stuck around to stack chairs after the event, to deepen their connection with the staffers, and walked out after everything was put away, and walked out with a congresswoman herself, where she talked about wanting to do more work with Citizens Climate Lobby's group. The group continued to meet with the office every CCL lobby day in Washington, D.C., and helped find experts from both in-district and in D.C. that were trusted sources of information for their conservative representative. This encouraged Representative Love to host a town hall meeting on the topic of climate change in order to learn more about it and to hear from her constituents on the issue. The Utah Town Hall was a positive, informative, solutions-oriented discussion and even featured the National Geographic Years of Living Dangerously TV program. At every step of the way, the group made it clear that they wanted to work together with Representative Love, to which she shared their approach, not only changed my mind about involvement, but really changed my heart about what we should be doing.
And this really is the value of appreciation. Thank you, Amy. We use it to begin our meetings or letters to the editor, but it's not just a kickoff device. We work to keep appreciation in our mind throughout our interactions. And it's important because some people will have a predisposed view of us, like we do of them. And so asking ourselves to appreciate them not only changes their view of us, but also takes that chip off of our own shoulder. This is basic human psychology that we each can work on. It helps us to remove our own biases and to see that other person as someone that we want to work with instead of seeing them as an obstacle. As Representative Love's example highlights, this approach puts us in a generous place that allows us to seek understanding and build out that common ground. When we sincerely show appreciation, one of the things you'll notice is a change in body language of the other person. They might open up when they see that you didn't come to shake your fist at them. Representative Love has not only come out with her own op-ed that's titled, We Can Find Climate Solutions and Still Have a Thriving Economy, but she's even begun to actively mail her own constituents about climate solutions and the importance of all members of Congress to take action to address climate change. So this is our one rule. If you remember one thing from this webinar, we hope it's this. Treat everyone, even those who disagree with us, with respect, appreciation, and gratitude. And for a more full story about the evolution of Representative Love's transformation, go online to the Years of Living Dangerously webpage and look for Laying the Groundwork for Love. And I'll pass it back over to you, Amy.
Thanks, Brett. Next, we're going to do an exercise about finding common ground and developing your story. In an interview with the New York Times in 1969, E.B. White, the author of Charlotte's Web, among other books, said, "Every morning I wake up torn between the desire to save the world and the inclination to savor it. This makes it hard to plan the day." And if we forget to savor the world, what possible reason do we have for saving it? In a way, the savoring must come first. Let me repeat that last part. If we forget to savor the world, what possible reason do we have for saving it? I think we can all identify with this sentiment. In the exercise that we'll be doing in just a minute, we'll ask you to identify a specific place that you love that's threatened to be negatively impacted by climate change. Not the beach and not a place that's threatened by other environmental factors like overdevelopment or toxic pollution. If it's in your hometown and congressional district, all the better to help establish common ground.
And the reason that we ask this is that social science research has shown people connect much more strongly with their own backyard and concerns for their own community than far-off impacts. So think about what your place looks and sounds like and try to paint a picture of what that's like. Using as descriptive of imagery as you can, using rich language, tell us about how that place feels and help us really understand what your place is like. You know, this exercise is a way to begin developing a story that you can share with others. Stories are very powerful means, perhaps the most powerful, of connecting with people, and the more prepared we are to share our own story and make that personal connection, the more likely we are to impact and influence change. These stories are also a way for us to humanize climate change, to make it part of our own stories and help those around us deepen their concern for caretaking, given not only the common ground we share for the natural world, but the common economic livelihood that is backed up by that natural world. So let me give you a specific example from my own life. And then what we're going to actually ask you to do is think about an example of your own that you can share. And while I'm sharing, feel free to start writing down notes of your own place. So I came into climate advocacy by way of 7 years of wilderness instruction in the boundary waters of northern Minnesota. Under the tall, towering, coniferous white pine of the Aurora Borealis, there's expansive, cool, crystal blue lake waters and haunting cry of loons. I also attended my first regional Citizen Climate Lobby conference and heard the lead Minnesota forestry researcher professor share that his studies were highlighting that that same great boreal woods were retreating northwards towards Hudson Bay at a rate that averaged out to be roughly 10 feet each day. Doing that math, we realized in that seminar that business as usual greenhouse emissions would mean that this wholly special northern border country of moose and pine, walleye and timber wolf would give way to landscapes more akin to scrub oak savanna, and that that would not only negative impact the personal growth and transformation of the lives that I saw and the youth I took out on paddle trips, but would also have repercussions for local guiding, fishing, hunting, tourist-based economies throughout the northern part of the state that many people depended on. And so we'd like you to ask and think about what you savor and how you could share that story as well. Think about your own connection to your special place and the climate impacts it faces. If possible, tie in the potential impacts of local economies that your community faces as well. Reduced worker or agricultural productivity, extreme heat, inland flooding, disease vector expansion, seafood yields. There are so many ways to make your story personal and connected to common concerns like the natural world and economic well-being. I will say that being able to verbalize and say what you savor or what you're for can really be the basis of more productive dialogue. Based on personal experience, to be able to demonstrate to others that you share common ground and that you are for something is a more powerful way of creating political will than to be against something. This is an important distinction because Citizens Climate Lobby is not fighting against any industry or the oil and gas companies. Rather, what we are for is a market-based approach to reducing and managing greenhouse gas emissions. And to close this first part of the webinar, I'll pass it back to you, Amy.
Well, let's talk about how all of these things, showing respect and appreciation, looking for the best in others, being for something and finding common ground, help us build relationships. Here's a powerful case study example of building a relationship with members of Congress that's led to political will that was featured just this last May in the New York Times. Here's a photo of Jay Butera. Jay's worked to address climate change for more than a decade and has been a volunteer with Citizens Climate Lobby since 2012. In 2013, he met with Representative Ted Deutsch, a Florida Democrat whose district was experiencing the effects of global warming. Jay mentioned that he had a vision to create a bipartisan caucus in the House of Representatives that would focus on climate solutions. Deutsch liked the idea and agreed to work with him and Citizens Climate Lobby towards that goal. And I quote, "The kind of meaningful conversation that was taking place in boardrooms and local governments, unfortunately, had not really taken place in Congress," Deutsch told Jay.
And so Jay started visiting offices on Capitol Hill in an effort to get Republicans and Democrats to sit down together. At the time, it seemed like a fool's errand, he said. People would laugh and say, good luck with that. The word climate was unmentionable. Jay and Deutsch then devised a two-by-two approach. The caucus would grow by twos to keep equality of numbers between Republicans and Democrats. Many Democrats were interested. The question was how to get Republicans to join. So Jay reasoned the first movers were likely to come from Florida. The coastal districts are mainly Republican, and the coastline is threatened existentially by climate impacts, he said.
So Jay flew to Miami, and he attended events in southern Florida that focused on climate change. And there he met locals and helped them start a Citizens Climate Lobby chapter. "I saw mayors and county leaders were dealing with the impacts of climate change head on," he said. "Some towns had raised roads and moved wells miles inland to escape seawater intrusion. In other places, seawater poured into the streets at every high tide." Jay discovered that Congress members in Washington were disconnected with the reality on the ground.
And so for the next 2 years, Jay and many other organization volunteers worked to address that disconnect. Jay organized countless meetings in Florida and Washington. He took video and photographs of climate effects and shared them with congressional offices. And he and others reached out to get 55 local leaders, including mayors, county commissioners, presidents of chambers of commerce, state legislators, and university presidents throughout South Florida, most of them from Republican-held congressional districts, and asked them to sign a letter asking Congress to act on climate change. It made a difference. It led directly to the formation of a Republican-introduced House resolution, 195 that you see here, that has been reintroduced this Congress, as well as highlighting that Republicans can and must take meaningful and responsible action on climate change. Additionally, one of those first Republicans to step forward for the climate resolution was Representative Carlos Curbelo. And in February 2016, he joined Representative Deutsch and as co-chairs formed the first ever bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus, a bipartisan group in the U.S. House of Representatives, which is exploring policy options now that address the impacts, causes, and challenges of our changing climate.
And today the caucus has 50 members, 25 from each party. And it'll continue to serve as an organization to educate members on the economically viable options to reduce our climate risk. What Jay and the rest of the Floridians did is a perfect example of how demonstrating respect and appreciation for others, even those who we think oppose us, finding common ground and building relationship leads to political will. They met with their Congress members and appealed to what was best in them. They created political will locally and allowed these members of Congress to respond to it. And now Brett's going to talk about how we begin to plan for a meeting with our members of Congress.
Thank you, Amy. I think this is a great time to promote that all of what we're about to review is available on CCL Community. And that website is simply community.citizensclimatelobby.org that you see there in the right-hand side of the screen. And to find these materials, you go to that red highlighted section, Take Action Center, and then follow the pathway to lobby Congress. And even though no two meetings are the same, the basic outline that we're about to follow really is. So prior to the meeting, what we do is research on our member and their district. You know, we learn what they're really proud of, what they like, and what they're really accomplished with. Learn what annoys them so they will know not what to bring up. Research local impacts of climate change and learn how fee and dividend will impact their state or district. We'll also make sure to review previous meeting minutes and then determine ahead of time who will be responsible for following up with those action items that we agree to in the meeting. Lastly, we make sure to assign specific roles to specific volunteers, and these can encompass anything from being a leader to the timekeeper to being the note taker or the main person that asks our proposal.
And we meet in teams of 4 to 6 Citizens Climate Lobby members. Our basic meeting outline goes as follows. We thank the member or staffer for meeting with us. The timekeeper asks, how much time do you have for this meeting? We introduce ourselves briefly. If we're meeting with a staffer, then we ask them to tell us a little bit about themselves. We show appreciation for something they've done recently, something you can sincerely appreciate. It doesn't have to be about climate or the environment. We briefly explain our purpose to create the political will for a livable world and briefly state our request to support or introduce legislation that puts a fee on carbon-based fuels and returns the net revenue to American households. Then we mention that we have more to say on that, but first we'd like to discuss your concerns. So, listening and discussion. Here are some possible questions you could ask to further the discussion. But be flexible based on your relationship. For instance, rather than reacting to their answer, it's most important to help them feel heard. You might ask the Congress member or staffer, what might be preventing the representative from supporting our legislation? Or who in our district would we need to convince about the merits of our proposal to win your support? Or what's your preferred plan to lower emissions? Having done your research, you'll probably be able to anticipate what you think their responses might be.
Finally, we want to make sure to deliver our ask. So if they've already indicated that they're not ready to introduce or support our policy, we also want to make sure to introduce a secondary request as that building block, again, moving them up the ladder of engagement on the policy. We want to make sure that we're offering additional materials and ask if they'd like them via hard copy or electronically. And then ask how and when we should follow up. We want to make sure we're always finding out who they like to work with across the aisle. And then we want to make sure to end on time and to thank them for their time. And that's really the overview of how we conduct a meeting with a congressional office. And though we don't have time tonight, we actually encourage everyone to seek out this opportunity with their group and practice in person, as well as to look this up online. If you go to Citizens Climate University's Lobby 301 and 401 lessons, highlighted here on the screen, you can actually see what this outline looks like in action, as a couple of teams actually practice these points with a couple of actual simulated run-throughs prior to the meeting. It's really important that we make sure that everyone does have a team practice before meetings, and as you can see, there's more detailed training on lobbying on the Learning Center in community. All right, so we have one more thing to cover, and that's CCL's legislative proposal. It's called Carbon Fee and Dividend, and you've heard us say that Citizens Climate Lobby is betting the farm on a market-based solution. So what exactly does that mean? Let's start with a quick review of where today the price we consumers pay for fossil fuels is artificially low. And this is due to a variety of factors, from before production, fossil fuel producers receiving discounted leases on public lands and offshore drilling, and then during production, fossil fuel producers receiving subsidies, special tax breaks, and eminent domain for pipelines. Again, keeping in mind that for the majority of our country's history, we wanted to incentivize and develop these fuel sources to boost our economic growth. And then after production, the price we pay for fossil fuels doesn't also include some huge hidden costs. And these hidden costs are known as externalities by economists. Some of them include the U.S. military. It spent trillions of dollars protecting our energy supply lines historically across all the world. Health costs and concerns. The use of coal increases healthcare costs $300 to $500 billion a year, according to some estimates. And then, of course, there are environmental costs and climate costs that are associated with adapting to and mitigating the effects of changing climate system. And again, these costs will rise and become more expensive the longer we put off acting on them. So if a market price for any product, not just fossil fuels, doesn't or include its real costs, economists have a term for that. They call it a market failure. And global warming has been called by some to be the greatest market failure in the history of capitalism. Economists say that the best first step then to correcting a market failure is to hold a product accountable for its costs. And this is the good news. With fossil fuels, this means moving these hidden costs that we discussed earlier, you know, from military, environmental, health, or climate concerns, back onto the front end of those balance sheets. The idea of putting a price on carbon is really simple then. We want to add the cost of doing business in those resources because we want to reveal the hidden costs that no one's taking responsibility for at present. Getting the price right means making the market tell the truth. And that means ordinary people like you and me, consumers, small businesses, taxpayers, will recover that market leverage that we're supposed to have to determine whether we do something that is too costly or not. In Citizens Climate Lobby, we emphasize that with all costs fully accounted for, then we let fossil fuels compete with other forms of energy in the marketplace. And when consumers realize the true cost of burning fossil fuels, they will make a more informed and better decision leading to a clean energy economy. I'll pass it back over to you, Amy, to go over several policy options right now that we do or that are available to manage gas emissions.
Well, there are really four basic options that are important to understand at the key differences between them. It's also important to note that each of these options will work. However, each varies in terms of the levels of enforcements, the costs, and the winners and losers from the policy. First policy is regulation. Straight regulation has been the most heavily used way to tackle our emissions reductions. It's historically prevalent because when we see the negative impact from routine behavior, it's been logical for some public authority to take action and to make sure that that activity does not harm others. In a strict regulatory scenario, you need people with salaries monitoring the behavior of emitters. This tends to get expensive, and as evidenced by the current administration, it can be undercut by underfunding. Overall, it's most useful where less intrusive options are just not available or don't work. Next, there's cap and trade. It sets a cap or a maximum for total emissions and sells permits for the right to pollute up to that cap. It allows for the trading of permits, and this approach is what Congress voted on in the House and approved back in 2009. Cap and trade creates a regulation enforced by the trading of artificial assets, the permits. It can help reduce emissions, but it's complex, creates uncertainty or volatility in the marketplace, and requires new regulatory mechanisms, both for the cap and for the trading market, and is usually narrower in scope. For example, it covers less total emissions than a more straightforward carbon tax.
Great. So, like we mentioned earlier, taxes begin to account for the cost of something that generates hidden costs, so that the tax eliminates market distortions and allows enterprise to go to work. So, with a carbon tax, instead of requiring regulation to get bad behavior under control, a straight-up tax operates on the assumption that if consumers understand the true costs, then the harm will be eliminated by putting economic pressure on suppliers to reduce that harm. Think of examples like cigarettes or alcohol. And one of the problems with a straight carbon tax, however, is that it is designed to pressure consumers to reduce consumption, which then in turn can constrain overall economic activity. To understand this, the Congressional Budget Office has looked at some carbon taxes before. In one of their analyses, the CBO says that carbon taxes are a drag on the economy. The Congressional Budget Office tells Congress that a $10 per ton carbon tax on CO2 emissions, for example, would raise about $55 billion in federal revenue annually, raise gas prices about 10 cents a gallon, raise electricity prices about a penny per kilowatt hour. It would slow job and GDP growth while still cutting carbon dioxide emissions very little. So overall, it's clear that a poorly designed carbon tax can have a negative impact on the economy. However, and that's a big however, there's a final option available that Citizens Climate Lobby is advocating for, and that's carbon fee and dividend. And to overcome the constraint on economic activity that would result from a straight-up carbon tax, while still reducing the harm caused by burning fossil fuels, CCL proposes carbon fee and dividend, which we like to think of as a three-legged policy. First, the fee and dividend. It places a steadily rising fee on all carbon-emitting fuels as upstream as possible. So at the source of the wellhead, the mine, the port of entry, the pipeline, wherever that fuel is first introduced into the economy. And this is greatly minimizing the amount assess such a fee, which would start at $15 a ton annually and increase by $10 a year thereafter. Then, the second leg, revenues are then returned directly to households in a monthly dividend check with half shares to children up to two per households. The dividend return would be simple to administer and is estimated to protect at least two-thirds of consumers from rising energy costs and related cost of good increases. Lastly, as we discussed in the first climate advocate training class, we propose a border adjustment so that goods produced in the U.S. then are also treated the same as goods produced in foreign countries. Getting that border adjustment is crucial because it ensures that domestic manufacturers have no incentive to move operations to a country that doesn't have an equivalent price on carbon, and that if other countries want to keep using dirty manufacturing processes, they'll have to pay the American people for that privilege. Our legal trade law team also assures us that there are in fact two provisions that make it clear carbon fee and dividend would be compliant with the WTO.
So in a quick review, fee and dividend requires no new spending, no new bureaucracy, no new regulation, and it allows the mainstream economy to keep chugging along and even expand, while sending a direct price signal to investors that the smart path for future investing is moving towards low carbon energy sources. A clean fee and dividend plan allows even the energy sector to transition investments cost effectively, so we see economic gain, not harm. I should point out that revenue neutrality, returning the net revenues to American households, is also politically important. We desperately need Republican leadership on climate. Most Republican members of Congress signed a pledge not to support any net tax increase. Politically, revenue neutrality means Republicans can vote for Citizens Climate Lobby carbon fee and dividend without violating their pledge. And now Brett's going to talk a little bit more about the Congressional Budget Office, or the CBO.
Great. So let's wrap this up by thinking about what would the Congressional Budget Office's economic analysis of carbon fee and dividend look like? Well, we don't know yet because we haven't had it scored, but from our REMI report, we see that all of their yardsticks would flip from negative to positive. I've mentioned REMI, chosen for its track record of providing analysis to both government bodies and fossil fuel corporations. REMI, which stands for Regional Economic Modeling Incorporated, had an analysis that concluded that instead of being a drag on the economy, such a system would actually have strong economic effects on the nation's health and prosperity alike. So instead of slowing job growth, jobs would actually grow faster. Over 20 years, CCL's proposal would generate an extra 2.8 million American jobs. Instead of slowing GDP growth would also accelerate faster. Over 20 years, an extra $1.3 trillion is anticipated in GDP growth. And then no matter how high that carbon fee goes, most consumers would see no net increase in their energy costs. And that's because the monthly dividend check would cover, or more than cover, all their rising energy costs. And that includes both direct energy costs, like gas and electricity, as well as indirect energy costs to produce goods and services that are carbon intensive. Finally, with carbon fee and dividend, instead of a modest cut in carbon dioxide emissions, by 2035, emissions would be cut in half. In other words, Citizen Climate Lobby's solution matches the scale and the timing of the problem that we face, putting us on a path to reduce our carbon dioxide emissions by 80% based on 1990 levels by mid-century. And so, Mark Twain said, the difference between the right word and the almost right word is the difference between lightning and a lightning bug. And this webinar's takeaway is this: there's a big difference between a carbon tax and a carbon tax that's revenue neutral. Words matter.
I know that's a lot of information we covered in a short amount of time, but we have plenty of resources available on our website. And you can find them on our Climate Solutions tab that's highlighted there in red. You can also visit our Learning Center on our sister website, CCL Community, and find all sorts of lessons. Not only a review of the introductory sequence, but the expansive list of featured here devoted to explaining carbon fee and dividend.
And so for today's lesson, we'd like to close with an inspirational quote. This comes from Frances Hodgson Burnett, who wrote The Secret Garden. At first, people refuse to believe that a strange new thing can be done. Then they begin to hope it can be done. And then they see that it can be done. And then it is done. And all the world wonders why it was not so long before. And to close, I'd just like to show this chart. We had Climate Interactive's Drew Jones on our International July call, and he shared this image from Bloomberg Media and said that social change looks impossible until it's completed. He reminded us to think back in US history about examples that are highlighted in this chart, from interracial marriage to women's suffrage. And for those years, all of those movements that were building, it seemed as though nothing was happening, even when hundreds or thousands of people worked to advance their causes. And then, suddenly, something shifted and the change happened. He closed by saying this: it could be that we're right on the cusp of huge support for the kinds of actions that we're advocating for that will really surprise us, and this movement to support a carbon fee and dividend could be imminent.
If you've completed the Climate Advocate lesson number 2, is if you've also participated in Climate 1, congratulations, you've completed our training module. Next steps would include joining CCL Community, our sister website, and you can register for a login and password at community.citizensclimatelobby.org. Brianna at headquarters will send you a login and password within a few days. Then check in with the group nearest you, and Brianna at Citizens Climate Lobby also can help you find the group and the group leader's email address. Email the group leader and attend their next meeting. If there's no group near you, Brianna will provide you with a state or regional coordinator's email address. And if you don't hear back from Brianna or a group leader, contact Brett or I. Emails can end up in spam files, and we'll help you get through that if you think that's the case. Our contact information is amy@citizensclimate.org and brett@citizensclimate.org. We're growing by leaps and bounds, and our goal is to support you in this important work. So contact us if you need help, and we'll do our best to direct you to solve whatever issue you have.
Thank you for joining us. We look forward to working together to build the political will for a livable world.